the music has stopped, which means it's time for me to start speaking. Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Ben Armstrong, Program Manager on the Hyper-V team, and I'm here today to talk about some of the work and some of the details behind the Hyper-V performance and scale work and architectural changes in Server 2012. Before I get going, I do want to just say sessions like these are one of the reasons why I love coming to TechEd Australia. Because honestly, TechEd Australia is about the only show left in the world where when I come out, I get asked, Ben, please do a level 400 session. Almost anywhere else I go these days, if I ask to do a level 400 session, they're like, oh, no one wants to go that deep. I'm excited to be able to chat at this technical level with you guys. It is my hope that, one, you're going to learn new stuff today, and two, if I do my job well, that you'll be a little overwhelmed with the information. So we'll see how we go on that. I will say ahead of time, I actually don't have a clock. So if I'm running over time, please feel free to wave hands and start throwing things to indicate. Hopefully we'll land on time okay. I do have my phone up here, which I'm going to try and glance at every now and then, but unfortunately the screen turns off, so it's a bit tricky. So what I'm going to be talking about today is what we had to do for scale and performance in this release. And here's the little table where I show where we were with the first release of Hyper-V, what we did in 2008 R2, and then what we've done in Windows Server 2012. And what you can see is that this is not a small release for us when it comes to scale and performance. On most of these, we're looking at a minimum of a 4x improvement. You know, in some of these, it's much greater than 4x. You know, and that's not common for scale and performance. You know, normally when you work scale and performance, you work on a release and you have goals of like, let's increase our scale by 10%, 20%. Not let's increase our scale by 5x. And let me explain some of the thinking behind this work, because I have had a number of people who look at these numbers and come up to me and say, yep, those numbers are kind of crazy. You know, they're out there. I'm never going to run at that sort of scale figure. And there are two things I'd like to let you know about these numbers. The first one is one of the biggest motivations for us working in scale and performance on this release was we had a simple mission statement, and that was there should be no workload that can't be virtualized. And what we found with 2008 R2 is we would go out and we would talk to people who are really enthusiastic about virtualization. And they would say, yeah, we virtualize everything. And we would say, really? You virtualize everything? And they would say, well, actually, we virtualize everything except... And the interesting thing was, it was always the same except. Except that SQL cluster. And they always had this high utilization database workload that they were still putting on physical hardware. And we really made it a goal for this release. We don't want to hear about that anymore. We want to be able to go and talk to people who are bought into virtualization and hear them say, yeah, we're virtualizing everything, even that SQL cluster. The second thing, and I'm going to be touching on this in multiple places as I'm going through, I do want to be very clear, none of these numbers are fictitious. You know, none of these numbers are, we think it should work if we do the math, if we look at the code. Every one of these numbers is tested and tested at load. And what I mean by that is when we say things like, we can do 4 terabyte RAM, 64 VP virtual machine, we tested that with active SQL load. When we say we can do 8,000 virtual machines in a cluster. We tested that, A, with active VDI workload, and B, we didn't just, you know, get 8,000 virtual machines up and running for a moment in time and go, woo! No. We tested all the functionality. We tested live migration. We tested failing over. We tested everything. So we feel confident that, hey, these aren't just numbers on a page. These are things you can legitimately do with Hyper-V and any workload. So now I'd like to jump in and start talking about some of the fundamental changes and things we had to do. The first thing I'm going to talk about is what did we have to do to be able to say, okay, we support a physical computer that has up to 320 logical processors. By the way, side note, I always have to dig at my competition when I get an opportunity. That's more than VMware can support. Have to point it out. Even with vSphere 5.1, more than VMware can support. And it's interesting. We play this kind of game of cat and mouse with our hardware partners. Because, of course, our hardware partners want us to support huge numbers of logical processors so they can sell the high-end metal. However, as I said, we don't ship theoretical numbers. We only ship what we've been able to test. So we have this interesting game that goes back and forth where the OEMs and hardware partners will come to us and be like, hey, can you support, 320 logical processors? And we'll say, hey, can you give us a box to test that with? And so it's kind of interesting. We have had pre-release hardware with 320 logical processors that we've tested at. But this gave us some interesting challenges. For those of you who are familiar with the history of Windows and scale, you'll know that it wasn't that long ago that 320 logical processors was more than Windows could handle, let alone Hyper-V. So one of the biggest changes that we made to support this is actually what we call Hypervisor Early Launch. And if you're familiar with the kind of the high-level Windows Server 2008 R2 architecture, you've probably seen we have a great PowerPoint slide we like to do where we show you, okay, you install Windows Server on the box, you enable Hyper-V, you reboot, Windows starts booting, and very early on, it launches the hypervisor. Well, in Windows Server 2012, we've made a fundamental change here in that you install Windows Server, you enable Hyper-V. When you reboot that box, the first thing to start is actually the hypervisor. Before the first instance of Windows starts running in the parent partition, we start the hypervisor. So why is this important? Well, one of the distinguished engineers on the Windows kernel team once described the job of Hyper-V as, it's your job to lie to Windows about what's happening. And you guys do a very good job of it. And it's true. As a virtualization layer, we are constantly lying to Windows and saying, this is the way things are. Trust us. Well, with the architecture we had in 2008 R2, there was a short window of time between when Windows started and when the hypervisor started, where for a short window of time, the parent partition could actually see the truth about the hardware that it was running on. And that was actually kind of a challenge for us because we want to be able to have tighter control. So in Server 2012, the hypervisor loads first, and even the parent partition, all it ever sees is the information that the hypervisor gives to it. So why did we do this? Well, that was done to enable a feature that we call the minimal parent. And what we actually do is if you have a physical box with more than 64 logical processors, so cores, hyperthreads, any over 64, we actually dedicate purely to virtualization, and the parent partition doesn't see them. So if you have a box with 320 logical processes, or 160, or 80, when you start, you enable Hyper-V, you come up, that parent partition is now only going to see 64 virtual processors, and we're going to keep the rest aside for virtualization. We've done that for a couple of reasons. The first reason is, once we start getting to these large scale points, the workload that we need the parent partition to do doesn't scale with the workload of the virtual machines. So frankly, if you have, you know, 300 odd physical processors in your box, your parent partition doesn't need access to all of those in order for us to run virtual machines. And by getting the parent partition off of some of those processors, we're able to get higher levels of efficiency in scheduling and utilization. The second reason is it made the architecture easier for us. This is a refactor that we've been wanting to do for a while. Something that I've always told people is you need to think of the parent partition as just the first virtual machine. Because that's what it is. It's the first virtual machine on the platform. And while we were going in and doing this, we said, you know what? We're going to impose the same limits on the parent partition as we do on the virtual machine. So we only support virtual machines with up to 64 virtual processors. Parent partition is the first virtual machine. It's limited to 64 virtual processors. That decision actually helps us a lot in some of our scheduling discussions. But if you don't have access to a high-end high-end physical computer, you can actually play around with this. We've introduced some new BCD edit flags, where you're probably familiar, we have the numprocs flag. We now let you go in and specify, hey, rather than numprocs, you know, it's numrootprocs, and it will restrict the parent partition. We have gone through and made sure that this gets shown in various places in the UI correctly. So if you actually have a look here, this is on a box which has 8 logical processors, and we went in and we used BCD edit to tweak things around. And you can actually see here that Task Manager is saying, hey, this box has 8 logical processors, but the host, the parent partition, is only seeing 2 of them. So we show that information in Task Manager. We show it in performance counters. We've also updated a couple of other places where people commonly go and look for this information. Something to be aware of, though, is if you're using a system management tool that hasn't been updated for Server 2012, it's going to see whatever the parent partition is limited to. Because the traditional APIs for, hey, how many cores do I have, that shows, you know, the 64. We've added new APIs that allow you to go in and say, okay, but how much does the physical box actually have? So that's what we had to do for supporting, you know, the 320 logical processors on a physical box. The next thing we did was 64 virtual processors in a virtual machine. And I'm going to spend a bunch of time talking about why some people, our competitors, say that doing large virtual machines is hard, and why we don't. So hopefully this is going to be some 101 for you guys. Hopefully this is something you're all familiar with. You know, you have virtual machines, you have a hypervisor. Obviously we have a scheduler. You know, you can't run everything at once, and you watch for workload, and you schedule workload as it needs to run. Now, this is very simple when you're talking about uniprocessor virtual machines. So I've got a little graphical walkthrough here where we imagine, okay, I've got 4 cores, I've got a hypervisor, I've got a bunch of uniprocessor virtual machines, and workload comes, we schedule workload, it gets handled. More workload comes in while that's happening, so we schedule it. It gets handled. And that's the basics of a scheduler. But things can get really interesting when you start looking at multiprocessor virtual machines. Because historically, operating systems have made this crazy assumption. Okay, it is completely reasonable in physical hardware. problematic for virtual machines. They've assumed that all my processors are going to be running at the same time. It's reasonable for hardware. But what happens is that you get code in these operating systems where a stream of execution on one processor takes a dependency on a stream of execution on another processor. And if those processors aren't running at the same time, things just fall apart. In your best case scenario, you get massive performance degradation. In your worst case scenario, things actually crash. And this is a problem for virtualization. So I actually, this turned out much better than I expected it to. I put together that first little graphic with the single processor, and I just randomly chose, like, yeah, workload here, workload there. Then I took the same slides, only this time I've grouped some of these. This is a technique that's referred to as gang scheduling. And I've grouped some of these, and now with just, you'll see, I have a bunch of single processor virtual machines. I have two processor virtual machines and one four processor virtual machine. And now I'm going to run exactly the same workload through this theoretical set. These slides are available afterwards. You can go and double check. It is exactly the same virtual process as the light up workload. But here, immediately, you can see that it's not possible for us to fully utilize the physical processor. No matter what combination we use here, we are going to be scheduling some virtual processors that don't have work to do. So I'm only at 50% utilization. And because of that inefficiency, what you're going to see is that my scheduler really struggles to keep up with the workload. This isn't working. So I spent some time thinking about how to describe this to someone. And a little moment of truth here. When I went to university, I did a double major in computer science and applied mathematics. And in mathematics, I specialized in statistical analytics. And as someone with that background, I can tell you the world is full of scheduling problems. So a great example of where you see this in the real world is if you ever go to a restaurant. So there are two scenarios I'd like to step you through, and I'm sure that most people here have experienced this. The first scenario is you're going to one of your favorite restaurants with a group of friends and coworkers and so on. And normally, you'd go to this restaurant, you'd sit down, you know what you want, you'd order it, and you'd have your food in 20 minutes. However, this time you've gone with a group of friends. So you go and you sit down, you know what you want to order, but you have to wait while some guy at the other end of the table is debating whether he wants the steak or the chicken. And it's 10 minutes before the table's decided, and then they take your order. And of course, someone's ordered something really complicated, and they won't bring out the food until everyone's food is ready. And so now this restaurant that you know would have served you in 20 minutes normally, you've been sitting there for close to an hour before your meal comes out. Or, conversely, another scenario that I know probably most of us have experienced, you go to a restaurant, maybe by yourself, maybe with your husband, wife, significant other, you have a lovely dinner, things are great, and you get to the end, all you want to do is you want to pay and you want to leave. You're done. However, the next table over is this huge party. And all the waitresses are busy looking after them. And you're sitting there going, come on, I just want to give you my money and go. And these are actually real life examples of the problem with gang scheduling. You know, you get inefficiencies in the system. So, what did we do? Well, simply, we went, hey, we're Microsoft. We own Windows. Let's go and fix Windows so that we don't have to do gang scheduling. And what we actually did, and we made these changes in Windows Server 2008. We went in and we made changes to the Windows kernel, and this is a documented API that we have up under open specification, where any hypervisor can indicate to Windows and say, hey, I'm a hypervisor, and I do not guarantee that your processors will all run at the same time. And Windows, the Windows kernel, now accepts that and goes, okay, I'll be mindful of that as I'm scheduling things. And so Hyper-V, the Hyper-V scheduler that's in the hypervisor, actually doesn't track virtual machines. It tracks virtual processors. So what are some of the implications of this? The first implication is scalability isn't hard for us. Honestly, it isn't. What we had to do in order to support 64 virtual processors in this release from a hypervisor and from a scheduler point of view is we just had to test it. There were no significant architectural changes that we made in order to enable that scale point. The second thing, and I do have to hit on this, is because VMware don't use this method, because they utilize gang scheduling, they provide very strong guidance where they're like, please, please, please be really careful. Only give your virtual machines extra processors if they genuinely are going to use them, and if at all possible, run UniProcess. Now, the problem I see is a lot of people shifting from VMware to Hyper-V still keep that guidance in mind, and it absolutely does not apply to Hyper-V. I'm sorry, a long time ago, I used to be a server admin. I'm old school. I don't have UniProcessor server virtual machines. I'm sorry. I wouldn't run a server on a UniProcessor box. I won't run it in a UniProcessor virtual machine. No, all my server VMs are a dual processor at least. But that does not cost Hyper-V anything. If your guest isn't utilizing the virtual processor, we don't schedule it. There's no overhead. You know, so I talk to people and they're like, hey, well, I'll take questions at the end. And they say, hey, we have a bursty workload. Most of the time it's idle, but sometimes, you know, it may use 4 or 8 virtual processors. I say, so set the VM up with 8 virtual processors. If it's not using them, it doesn't affect the scheduler, and life's good. To go back to my restaurant analogy, and the marketing team hates me using this, but I like to say, if you think about the restaurant analogy, effectively, the Hyper-V scheduler is like going to a sushi train restaurant. You sit down, the food's there. You know, you don't have to wait for anyone else. It's all ready to go. So we've got 64 virtual processors. The next thing is what did we have to do for 1 terabyte of memory? First, we had to get insane amounts of memory. This was actually, I went down to the lab. In our lab now, we actually have one machine with 4 terabyte of memory and 2 machines with 2 terabyte of memory. And I remember the day that the 4 terabyte machine arrived, I went down and I met one of our testers. And he held a single DIMM in his hands from this box. I can't remember what the capacity was. It was some huge, insane amount. But he looked at me and he said, this is worth more than my house. And I said, don't drop it. So the first thing that we had to do for 1 terabyte of memory is, frankly, we had to do a lot of housekeeping. There was actually a lot of areas where, for instance, no one's actually ever come and complained to me about how long it takes to save state a virtual machine. No, because frankly, if you have a 16 gigabyte virtual machine and it takes a minute to save state, fine. No, but if you do the math, a minute to save state, 16 gigabyte, ends up being 2.5 hours to save state a terabyte. And that's a problem. You know, I don't think many people would view that as acceptable. So we've done a lot of housekeeping just around a lot of the state changes and a lot of the operations where we've tried to make these as efficient as possible. But one of the bigger challenges that we had was making sure that the performance scaled. One of the things that we were very clear about when we were working on these huge scale figures is, look, there's no point in us doing 64 virtual processors, 1 terabyte of memory, if our scalability is so bad that, you know, you only see a 10% performance improvement from 32 virtual processors and 512 gig. Now, we wanted to make sure we built a system where as you increase the size of your virtual machine, you saw scalability that was comparable to what you saw in hardware. So one of the big challenges we had around large memory for VM came from NUMA. Now let's just do a show of hands. How many people here are familiar with NUMA topology and how that affects memory performance? Good. I'd say about two-thirds. So NUMA is actually very common these days. You know, 8 years ago, it was quite rare and not many people knew about. But these days, chances are, if your box has more than one processor, it's a NUMA box. And NUMA presents a challenge for virtualization in that on NUMA systems, you need to make sure that your processors and your memory are running in the same node. You don't want your processors and your memory on different nodes because that will have performance effects, sometimes minor, sometimes significant. We've seen systems where accessing non-local memory on a remote NUMA node reduce your memory performance to 20% of what you normally would have got. You know, it's just horrific stuff. So traditionally, we've handled this by just going, okay, as much as possible, we'll try and make sure that for each virtual machine, all its virtual processors and all its memory are on a single NUMA node. And that's great. However, if you have a 64 virtual processor virtual machine with 1 terabyte of memory, I can tell you now, there isn't a box out there where that's going to fit in a single NUMA node. It just doesn't exist. So how do we handle that? Well, the way we handle that is we're now exposing the concept of a NUMA topology into the virtual machine. So we tell the virtual machine, hey, you are a NUMA-enabled system. You have multiple NUMA nodes. Each node has this number of virtual processors and this amount of memory. And then that becomes our unit of scheduling. That becomes that NUMA node. We just make sure it runs on a single NUMA node, as opposed to trying to fit the whole virtual machine into one NUMA node. And by doing this, what we do is we allow the guest operating system inside of the virtual machine, we allow the software running in that guest operating system to be aware that there's NUMA in the picture, and to perform the necessary optimizations for that architecture. So some things to be aware of here. The first thing is, by default, we do not enable guest NUMA until you have at least 8 virtual processors. If you have less than 8 virtual processors, actually, I believe it's at least 8 virtual processors, at least 64 gig of RAM. If you have under those, we don't turn on guest NUMA. We just go, fine, it's not a NUMA system. The second thing to be aware of, though, is when you create a large virtual machine, we try and put a virtual NUMA topology in there that makes sense for the hardware you're running on. However, if you're going to be migrating that virtual machine around and you have boxes with different NUMA topologies in your environment, that may not be the best configuration for every box in your environment. And you should be aware that if you have a virtual machine with virtual NUMA enabled and it doesn't match well with the underlying NUMA topology, you're going to see terrible performance and very unpredictable performance. So what we do is, even though we try and figure out the best NUMA topology for your physical box, we actually expose this in the UI, and we allow you to go in and tweak it. So we have a page that's under the processor settings, which is NUMA, and you can go in and you can specify the number of processors per NUMA node and the amount of memory per NUMA node. Now, if you're sizing this in your environment, it's actually relatively simple. what you're going to want to do is find the box in your environment that has the smallest NUMA nodes. So find the box that has the least number of processors per NUMA node and the least amount of memory per NUMA node, and that is your template. Size your virtual machines to that box for NUMA settings, and then you'll get the best performance. Where we see bad performance is if the processors and memory for the virtual NUMA node is greater than the processors and memory that the physical NUMA nodes can deliver. One thing that I will say, I have already done extensive training with the Microsoft support desk, and one of the things that I have warned them is someone is going to go in here and play with these settings without knowing what they're doing. They're going to hurt themselves. They're going to get bad performance. They're going to call you up. They're not going to know what's happening. And that is why we put this button here. Because what this button does is it just makes us rerun our math to figure out what makes sense for this box. So I've told the support team, if anyone calls you up and they're running on big iron with big virtual machines and they're seeing strange performance, the first thing you need to do is get them to go to this page and hit this button and see if the problem's solved. So this is, fiddling with these settings is a bit dangerous. So please be very careful. Think about your environment and make sure you're doing the right thing. So now I'd like to show you a demo, and this is actually a recorded demo, and you'll see why. So what this demo shows is this is us live migrating a virtual machine with 64 virtual processors, 1 terabyte of memory, and an active SQL workload. Now, I actually use time-lapse in this video because the actual migration itself takes about, in our lab, takes about 40 minutes. And while I would love to have this run for 40 minutes and just stand here quietly and be done with the session, I don't think that would get me the greatest review scores. I'll also highlight, you can see I have some red scratch-outs on the video. Unfortunately, my test team, being good, typical testers, named their servers after the model of hardware that they're running on, and one of these boxes has not yet been released. And I would get in trouble if the name was displayed on the screen. But the reason why I'm showing you this is there's a couple of reasons. One, I want to show you, like, hey, these scale points, one, we can run, and we can run hard at them. You know, this comes back to the we make sure we scale well. The second thing is, and this is something that, and I'll mention this later on with some other features, we really hold important that all of our features should work together. One of the things, I think it just dropped out of time-lapse because it's about to do the switchover. So it's just live migrated, and that's a remote desktop connection. It'll pick up in a second. So there, it just live migrated. Actually time-lapse because on this system, it actually takes a large amount of time to finish the migration. But, you know, we didn't want to tell people you can have these huge scale numbers if you give up everything that makes virtualization work. You know, and one of the things that we've heard really loud and clear is live migration and virtual machine mobility is crucial. And so something that, you know, we were quite adamant about is, you know, we're not going to sign off on a scale figure until we know we can live migrate at that scale, until we know. And I got to tell you, we had all sorts of fun with this. Two of the interesting challenges that we had around live migration. So I just showed you live migration in 40 minutes. One of the things that we document as a best practice is you should protect your live migration network, and we say to use a physically secure network, or if not physically secure, to use something like IPsec to protect it. So we made sure that we could live migrate a 1 terabyte 64 virtual processor machine with IPsec enabled. And I got to tell you, we found more bugs in IPsec than I think anyone else ever has. IPsec in Server 2012 is a lot better because of the work that we did. So we make sure that all this stuff works together. So we've talked about, let me just glance at my time. How am I going? Okay, we're good. So I've talked about scaling the processors, both physical and virtual. Talked about memory. But anyone who's spent significant time in the trenches with virtualization knows that these days, I.O. is it's the number one bottleneck. You know, and we want to make sure that, hey, we don't want to have these huge processor and memory figures and no one actually does it because we can't deliver the I.O. to back it up. So we spent a lot of time investing on delivering huge I.O. performance to these virtual machines. So the first thing I'm going to talk about here is what we've done on networking. So in networking, we are now supporting a relatively new technology called single root I.O. virtualization, or SRIOV for short. And a way to think about this is, you know, 10-odd years ago when we started on this whole journey of virtualization on x86 platforms, the processors themselves had no idea about virtualization. And we had to do a bunch of wacky stuff in software. And we could kind of make it work, but performance was not great. Intel and AMD came along and said, hey, this is important, and they extended their processors to have native understanding of virtualization in the hardware. Well, SRIOV is extending your network adapter to now have native understanding of virtualization in the network adapter. And what happens with SRIOV? So here we have our traditional model where we have a physical NIC going to the root or parent partition. We have the virtual switch there, and we're exposing a virtual NIC into the virtual machine. With SRIOV, we're able to call down into the physical switch and say, hey, we have a virtual machine over here. Can you please create a new virtual network adapter for it? By the spec, the SRIOV is an industry standard spec. They actually call these virtual functions. So please create, it's basically, please create a virtual instance of yourself. And it does it, and we're able to pass that directly to the virtual machine. And the virtual machine is then able to talk directly to that piece of hardware. Now, a couple of things I'd like to call out about this, because at a high level, you go, wow, that's cool. But there are some interesting implications, and there are some interesting things to be aware of. The first thing to be aware of is, why would you do this? Believe it or not, in most of our testing, the answer is not bandwidth. That's what everyone assumes. It's like, oh yeah, I'll do that. I'll get higher bandwidth. I'm sorry, our software is too good. You don't have to do this for higher bandwidth. In all our testing, even going down the old path, we're able to saturate 10 gigabit. You know, so if it's purely bandwidth, this isn't necessary. However, the benefits that we've seen, the first one is reduction in CPU. You know, we can do 10 gigabit on software, but we practically burn a core in the physical box in order to push that through. We do this with SRIOV, the amount of CPU cycles we use in the parent partition, zero. None. The second advantage of this is latency. If you have a application that's very sensitive to latency, you need ultra-low latency in your system, be looking at this because it is direct to hardware. It is the same latency as a physical box with a network adapter. Now, a gotcha that not many people realize, but it makes sense once you think it through, is one of the things that we've done in Server 2012 is we have the Hyper-V extensible switch. We have some sessions here at this event talking about that. If you use SRIOV, you don't get to use any of that stuff because your network traffic is not going through the virtual switch anymore. It's going straight to the hardware. Another example of a gotcha is in Server 2012, we finally, hallelujah, have support for inbox network teaming. However, you can't take advantage of network teaming in the parent partition if you're using SROV, because that network traffic is just not going through the parent partition anymore. So if you're looking at SROV and you want to have protection against link failure, what you actually need to do is you need to have two SROV-capable NICs in the box, two virtual NICs in the virtual machine mapped to each one, and do your teaming inside the guest operating system. That is something that we've tested and make sure works, but it's just something that you need to be aware of if you're looking at these sorts of deployments. Now, I'd like to spend some time talking about the last bullet point on this, because this is really cool. We're able to do this direct access to the hardware and still support live migration. And as I mentioned earlier, this is something that, you know, we're very adamant about, is making sure all these features work together. And I can tell you, as cool and as useful as SROV is, when we were designing this feature, if we hadn't been able to figure out how to make it work with live migration, we wouldn't have done it. Because honestly, and you guys know this, I know this, if we came out and said, hey, we've got this great feature that gives you awesome network performance, however, no live migration, you guys would be like, ah, great, never going to turn that on. I don't want to work on features that people don't use. So we did a lot of work to make live migration work. So how do we do this? Well, the first thing to be aware of is when we have SROV enabled on a network adapter, we actually expose both our traditional software path and the virtual function, the SROV path, into a virtual machine. And this is a bad word to use, but unfortunately there's no better word to use. We basically team them. But it's not Windows Server network teaming. It's a very lightweight team. And you can actually basically think of it as an either-or switch. And what we do is, if the virtual function is there and working, all network traffic goes through the physical device, and the software path isn't utilized. And we only utilize the software path if the physical path isn't there. I'll explain why that's important in a little bit. So we have this infrastructure, and what this means is when you ask to live migrate, all we do is, while the virtual machine's running, we remove the virtual function, pull it out, the virtual machine falls back to the software path. We then do a live migration like we normally would, and on the other side, we reestablish. So this means, one, we can do live migration with SROV, but we can actually do live migration with SROV even if you have network adapters from different vendors. We can even do it if some of your boxes have SROV enabled and some of them don't. We can still live migrate the virtual machine around. Now I have a demo. Before I get to that, I will just point out, John Howard has a blog. He did a fantastic series on SROV on his blog a little while ago. There's a handy link. If you're going to go and play with this, please go and read that, because he tells you in great detail all the caveats, all the gotchas, all the common mistakes. And trust me, you'll find life a lot easier if you read his blog before you go through and set it up. But now I'm going to show you. This is actually a demo that John Howard recorded for us. And what we're going to do is we're going to live migrate a virtual machine with SROV enabled between two different boxes. So right now this virtual machine doesn't have SROV enabled. This is just, it has a standard virtual network adapter. And we're going to use PowerShell to enable SREOV. And we actually have the network connection UI open, and we have the device manager open. And the reason why we have that is the device manager is actually the only place inside the guest OS where you can actually see whether SREOV is there or not. Because of the lightweight teaming that we do, the network connection remains unchanged throughout this. But what you're going to see is when we enable SREOV, a new network adapter device is going to appear inside the virtual machine. So there you can see we have the Intel 82599 virtual function. We have the ping going to show you that network connectivity isn't affected at all, but that virtual function has just come in, we've created the team, and everything continues to happen. Now, for some reason, John Howard thinks it's critically important that you see that the manufacturer ID is the one that Intel uses. Personally, it's not what I would choose to demo, but hey.
I wish that if I'd known John Howard was an IT expert, I might have voted for him.
So, we have the system. We now have a physical network adapter. It's the Intel network adapter in there, and we have traffic flowing directly through it. And what we're going to do is we're going to live migrate this to a second box, which actually has a Broadcom network adapter with IOV enabled. So here we go. And this is just it's not a shared nothing live migration, so it's quite a quick migration. And the key thing, what you're going to see the Intel device go away, you're going to see the live migration happen, and you're going to see the Broadcom device added. And throughout the whole thing, A, the ping's happening, B, let me just highlight, we're actually using RDP to connect to this VM. So the whole display is going over the network adapter while this is happening. There we go. The live migration is completed. We have a Broadcom device. The network traffic is now flowing through it. One thing I would like to highlight is actually some things to be considerate of when you're thinking about SREOV in your environment. We allow you to specify on the network adapter, I would like this to be SREOV enabled. So on the virtual network adapter for the virtual machine, there's an option to say, enable SREOV if possible. Unfortunately, it is not a guarantee. And it's not a guarantee because we have some issues with the SREOV spec. We're currently working with the committee that designs it to see if we can get this addressed. But the way SREOV works, every network adapter actually has a finite number of virtual functions that it supports. We've actually seen network adapters which have as few as 4 virtual functions. We've seen some with 32, 64. But there's a finite number of virtual functions. And from software, it's not actually possible for us to find out how many virtual functions a network adapter has. So unfortunately, where we are with the architecture today is we basically allow you to say, hey, if SREOV is enabled, please use it for this network adapter. We're going to power on that virtual machine, and if a virtual function is available, we'll hook it up. If it's not, we won't. We do show you through the UI whether this virtual machine currently has SREOV or not. I understand that that's not a perfect solution, but it's what we've got. So that's networking. Now I'm going to talk about storage. And honestly, we've done a huge amount of work in storage. And I'm not going to cover all of it. I don't have enough time to cover all of it. So I am going to just try and touch on some of the highlights and how they affect performance. So the first thing to be aware of is we have the new format, the VHDX format. And a couple of things to say about that. No one likes it when we introduce a new format. I get that. It's a bunch of work. It's a bunch of compatibility issues. But in our defense, I would like to point out first, the VHD format that we have today was designed in 1995 to allow you to run Windows 3.1 on a Mac. Frankly, it's done well to get this far. certainly it was not designed with the sort of scale and server virtualization that it's used for today. The second thing to highlight is, and this actually surprises a lot of people, Server 2012, not only do we support both VHD and VHDX, we provide conversion tools that allow you to convert from VHD to VHDX and back again. So if you have a mixed environment, we provide all the tools that allow you to move back and forth. But with that said, why do you want to use VHDX? Obviously, we have the much higher size, up to 64 terabyte. I will highlight the format theoretically can support something like 1.3 petabyte, but we only state that we support what we've tested, and we've tested up to 64 terabyte. We've made a lot of changes around sector alignment. I don't have enough time to go into this, but if the words 512E, 4K sectors, performance issues on different sector size SANs, if these words sound familiar to you, then the short answer that I have for you is everything works with VHDX. Seriously. Every problem that exists with sector alignment, with different size sectors, gone with VHDX. So, and if anyone comes up to me and asks me about these sorts of issues, my first answer is gone, go use VHDX. I don't want to talk about this. Problem solved. We've also made some changes to how we do allocation of data. Now, we made a very specific decision around how we allocate and pre-allocate data for dynamic disks in VHDX. And we made a trade-off where we said, you know what? We're going to use a bit more space to get a lot more performance. What does this look like? So I have to say this, and people who know me know that this is a rant, but I have to call this out because it's on the graph, and people always say this. Before we talk about the difference between VHD and VHDX, let me just highlight something. Pass-through disks aren't faster. Please do not use pass-through disks. Please, 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 please do not use pass-through disks. I hate it when people use pass-through disks. You use pass-through disks, you lose all the cool features. You lose snapshots. You lose host-based backup. You lose a lot of cool stuff. And every time that I talk to someone and they say, we're using pass-through disks, I say, why? And they say, well, we've got this really high-performance workload. I'm like, it does not matter. Use VHDs. That's the best path. Everything works, and you get great performance. Historically, I would have said, hey, if you care about performance, use VHDs and use a fixed VHD. And you can see here, fixed VHD, dynamic VHD. But these days, honestly, look at the difference here. You know, you're going to be not getting that much more. We've done a lot of work to make sure that dynamic VHDX is a great solution for any environment. That was 30K random writes. 1 meg sequential writes, there's no difference. So next thing we've done is some work for I/O scaling. And I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to try and speed up. Now, if you've been following the virtualization space for a while, you've probably heard the phrase a million IOPS mentioned a couple of times over the last couple of years. And frankly, for lack of a better phrase, it's been a bit of a pissing match between us and VMware. But we're currently winning, so I'll talk about it. That's the way it works, right? So you may be a bit confused because we've been talking about a million IOPS for a while now. And what actually happened was when this started, the claim to fame was we can drive a million IOPS from a single physical box. But what we were actually doing, both us and VMware, is we had a single physical box where we had 10 virtual machines. And each of the virtual machines were driving 100,000 IOPS. and sum total 1 million IOPS. So we both did that. And then with the next round, it was like, hey, we can do 1 million IOPS from 3 virtual machines. Well, guess what? We can now do it from 1. We can have a single virtual machine driving 1 million IOPS. I don't know what we're going to do next. You can't do half a virtual machine driving 1 million IOPS. We'll have to come up with something new. But what did we do to make this happen? Well, the bulk of the work for enabling this was changing our I/O architecture so that our storage infrastructure scaled with the rest of the system. So Server 2008 R2, we had 1 VM bus channel per VM. We had a single VP that was assigned for handling I/O, and we had a single queue for each SCSI device. So each SCSI controller, sorry. Keep in mind, Server 2008 R2, we only supported virtual machines with up to 4 virtual processors. So this architecture kind of made sense. However, with Server 2012, we're now supporting 64 virtual processors, 1 terabyte of memory. That architecture no longer made sense. And that architecture became the bottleneck for us. So what we've done now, we've made a number of changes. First, 1 I/O channel for each 16 virtual processors, so that as you scale up the virtual processors, we scale up the I/O. Second, we changed our queues from being per controller to being per device. And we changed our I/O interrupt handling from being statically assigned to a single virtual processor to being dynamically scheduled across multiple virtual processors. The net result is we now can do 1 million IOPS. In fact, in our labs, we've done somewhere around 1.3 million IOPS. But at TechEd Europe, we actually demonstrated 1 million IOPS from a single virtual machine on stage. The final thing I'd like to talk about with storage, I think this is the final thing. I hope I remember this deck properly. Every time I say the final thing on stage, I can guarantee that there's one more slide that I've forgotten about. We'll see. Is ODX. So ODX, as we've been talking about this, this is a new functionality in Windows Server 2012, where we're able to take advantage of the intelligence that exists in your SAN. So 2008 R2 and a nice fancy SAN on the back end. 2008 R2 really had no idea that that was a SAN. It just viewed it as any other disk. And when we would copy memory to and from that SAN, we would actually pull the daughter off the SAN, put it in the memory in the operating system, and write it back to the SAN. That's crazy. You know, these days, most of your SANs have incredible amounts of power on them, incredible amounts of logic. They're doing deduplication. They're doing all sorts of magic and tricks. And by treating them like a dumb disk, we're doing more work than we need to, and we're making them do more work than we need to. So ODX is a new system where rather than copying all the data into memory ourselves and copying it back, we ask the SAN for a token that represents the data. We figure out what we want to do with it, and we tell the SAN, hey, can you copy this file? Can you do this operation? And it's able to apply all its logic to do it more efficiently. Now, we've enabled this in Server 2012. We've also enabled it in Hyper-V. We've enabled it in 2 ways. The first way, which I'm going to show you a demo video, is all of our basic VHD operations, we now take advantage of ODX. VHD creation, merging, mirroring, etc. All takes advantage of ODX. The second thing, unfortunately, I don't have time to demo this, and frankly, this is one of those things, like, I understand how this works, but still, whenever I see it, for me, it borders on black magic. If you have a SAN with ODX capability, you've connected it to your Hyper-V server, you create a VHD on that SAN, you create a VM, you install Server 2012, you do a file copy inside the virtual machine, we've ODX enabled that. So that file copy inside that virtual machine using a virtual hard drive will still accelerate that through the SAN. That's actually, that blows my mind every time I see that. So the short demo I have today, and I do apologize. This is a video capture from TechEd Europe, and the video is rather poor, but it's grainy, but you'll see the demo. But first, a show of hands. How many people here have ever created a fixed VHD that's larger than 50 gig in size? It takes a while, doesn't it? I'm going to start this and go get a coffee. I'm going to start this and go out to lunch operation. So we have a simple little script here. Oh, nope, my video is missing. Damn. Let me see. I have a backup VHD. It looks like they messed this up in edit. I'm going to hook up my backup VHD while I do this because I really want to show you this video. It's cool. I'll tell you about it while I'm doing this. So we have a video demo where we have a script that creates two virtual hard drives, and they're both 100 gig fixed-size VHDs. One of them is created on an ODX-capable volume. The other is created on a non-ODX-capable volume. Oh, actually, I've got a little thing down here. Ah, there it is. It is here. Fantastic. So here you're going to see, we do a bunch of stuff around synchronization. Let me see if I can do that. To make sure this happens at the same time. Because we make sure, and we're not calling any special APIs here. We're just calling the PowerShell to create a 100 gig fixed size VHD. So you can see top one, done. 2 seconds. Non-ODX, 1%. So that's the difference. But I'll highlight, that's VHD creation. We've done the same for storage migration. We've done the same for merge. We've done the same for... So having an ODX-enabled SAN makes a huge difference to the performance of all these I.O. operations. And what's happening here, why ODX is so much bigger, so much faster in this case, is when we create a fixed-size VHD, we try to zero out all the data. Without using ODX, we're having to write out 100 gig of zeros. We're sending 100 gig of data over the interconnect to your SAN. With ODX, we just talk to the SAN and say, hey, we need 100 gig of zeros. And the SAN says, oh, yeah, I know where that is. And it goes and puts them together for us. So the thing I'd like to finish with is the results. And I had to do some begging and pleading and negotiating to be able to display this. But here is, and I'm not allowed to say what the exact workload that we used was. I can just say it was an intensive SQL workload. But we took an intensive SQL workload that we believe is representative of a high-end SQL server, and we tested it using the same physical hardware. And what we did was for both 32 and 64 VP, we took the physical hardware, we used numprox and whatever to cap the physical hardware down to match the size of the virtual machine. And we captured what the throughput was, the CPU utilization was, and what the throughput loss was. And I'm actually really happy to get this because I always get asked by people, yeah, but if I virtualize my SQL server, like, what's the loss? Well, here's what we've seen with testing. So for 32, we saw 12%. For 64, we saw 6%. And I do have to take a moment to boast here, because you may look at that and go, huh, that's strange. The overhead is less for 64 virtual processor than it is for 32 virtual processor. Let me spell it out in black and white. What that says is it says we scale better than SQL. So that makes me happy. But there, you know, we're really proud of this because, as I said at the beginning, you know, our goal was there should be no workload that can't be virtualized. You know, I don't want to be like 6 months' time, 12 months' time, I meet with one of you guys. I don't want to hear we virtualize everything but that SQL workload. Because I can tell you, Hyper-V Server 2012 is more than up to virtualizing that SQL workload. So I've got some related content here. You can contact me on Twitter at VirtualPCGuy. You can also go to my blog, Virtual PC Guy on MSDN Blogs. There's a feedback form there. I'd like to thank you all. I'd like to encourage you to fill in eval forms. If you've ever talked to a Microsoft speaker, you know that we have great internal competitions about this. So I will be checking my evals. Oh, one thing I will say, because I did this session at Tech Ed New Zealand, and in all fairness, this is a level 400 session. It's the most technical session they have. If you fill out the eval form and you check the option to say that the content was too technical, I will mock you. We had two guys in New Zealand who checked the box saying, too technical. What the? It's a level 400. You can't do too technical on a level 400. So that said, I'd like to open for questions. And I do have some shirts to give away for particularly good questions. So you, I told to wait, so I have to ask you first. So the question is, with the scheduling of multiprocessors, and that's a good question, so please come down and grab a shirt while I answer. With the scheduling of multiprocessors and how we do the decoupling, how do we handle operating systems that don't have this awareness? And I'll call out two things here. The first thing is, I do get people coming in saying, hey, it's great that you support 64 virtual processors. And by the way, we support 64 virtual processors for 2008 R2 and Windows Server 2012 guests. But they say, how come you guys still suck and only support two virtual processors for Windows Server 2003? And the short answer is, because that kernel has not had these modifications. If we're doing free scheduling, Server 2003 doesn't run well. The next obvious question is, well, what about Linux? Thankfully, we have our open source group who do great work with the Linux community, and we have actually got changes into the Linux kernel that are aware of this flag as well. That's part of the reason why we made sure that the hypervisor API for indicating this is documented under our OpenStack promise. The Linux operating systems behave well at scale, even when we're doing free scheduling of the virtual processors. By the way, kudos, because everyone, when I was putting this deck together, everyone was like, you know, someone's going to ask about Linux. So, good question. So the question is, have I noticed any packet inspection of virtual machines with the offloading features? I'll give you a shirt for that. The thing that I'll highlight, actually, I don't know, I think, okay, I should warn you, all these shirts are 2XL. I just thought I'd look at the shirts. I don't know. I wear small myself, so. Once again, the thing to be really clear about is if you're using these offloads, essentially your packet inspection has to be off the books. Any packet inspection that you're trying to do from another virtual machine, from the parent partition, you're not going to see it. Yep. Yep. So we've made some changes there. On the software path, you can now configure port monitoring and things like that, but none of that works if you're doing the hardware accelerations. If you're doing the hardware accelerations, your packet inspection must run externally. Is this all the people who aren't 2XL leaving? So the question is, are you guys working on equivalent for fault tolerance? I'm not going to give you a shirt for that because I'm not allowed to talk about future stuff. Come on. Sorry. So good question. You can get a shirt for that. So the question is, if your NIC is doing SROV, is that NIC effectively in promiscuous mode? No, it's not. And that's actually one of the benefits of SROV that I didn't call out. When we're doing our software virtualization, because the network adapter is not aware of what's going on with our software path, we do put the NIC into promiscuous mode, and that does add an overhead because we have to do packet filtering in software. With the SROV-enabled NICs, because the NIC is aware, it doesn't go into promiscuous mode, and instead it just listens for the specific MAC addresses that it cares about. So that's actually an advantage of SROV. Has there been any changes to the recommendation for snapshotting in production? I'll give you a shirt for that. Yes and no. So at a high level, our recommendation is still do not use virtual machine snapshots in production. I will tell you from a Hyper-V team point of view, and in speaking as I'm actually the program manager who owns virtual machine snapshots, I can tell you I am well and truly aware of the fact that no one listens to me. We've been saying don't use virtual machine snapshots in production all along, and everyone does. Well, we have VSS snapshots, and that's a separate thing, and that's fully supported in production. We're talking about the Hyper-V virtual machine snapshots. Now, I'll say from my point of view, and this is something that I've been talking to my team about, is I've been saying, look, we've been saying don't use these in production. No one's listening. Everyone's using them in production. And so we kind of now have a long-term goal for ourselves of let's get to a point where we feel comfortable saying, yeah, you can use these in production. And I can tell you in Server 2012, we have removed a number of the problems that existed around snapshots being used in production. The two biggest changes that have come in, the first one is we finally do live merge of VHDs so that when you delete a snapshot, we actually delete a snapshot. Novel idea. But that's a big one. The second thing that we've done is we've actually done a lot of work with the Active Directory team so that you can now have AD installed in a virtual machine, take a virtual machine snapshot, apply a virtual machine snapshot, and not corrupt AD. So we are not yet at the stage where we feel completely comfortable. We're kind of paranoid about this stuff. So we're not there yet. We are at the stage where if someone told me that they were using virtual machines in production, I wouldn't make a fuss. So I'd be like, oh, okay, fine. With 2008 R2, if someone told me they were using virtual machine snapshots in production, I'd be like, oh, dear Lord, please don't. Because you're just going to hurt yourself. With Server 2012, there are edge cases and there are things to be aware of. It's not something that we recommend for production. It is something that's supported. It's a supported feature. There are things you should be aware of. It's safer than it used to be, but it is not yet safe enough for us to go rubber stamp and go use this in production. Where can you get a list of those things to be aware of? Well, you can get a list of, from me, unfortunately. I need to write them down. How about dynamic disks? So, actually, and this is something that is very much like snapshots, and I do have to clear up some confusion about this because there has been a lot of confusion. The first thing to be really clear about, and people do get confused about this, is we don't ship stuff that we don't support, okay? You know, we publish best practices. We publish best practices like don't use virtual machine snapshots in production environments. That's a best practice. It doesn't mean that if you don't do that, you're not supported. You know, all our features are supported, and they are supported in production. Historically, we've stated dynamic disks are supported, but our best practice is to use fixed. Now, where that best practice came from was it came from the combination of you get better performance on fixed disks, and there is an inherent risk with dynamic disks that, hey, if you over-allocate your disk and you run out of space, and that's a problem. In Server 2012, as you saw with the graphs, the performance difference is so small that really the only real caveat that remains around dynamic disks is, hey, if you're using dynamic disks, please be careful about how you're managing your storage. Now, that said, if you're using intelligent SANs on the back end that support thin provisioning, that support trim and unmap, you're much better off using dynamic disks in that environment than using fixed disks. So you're going to see some talk back and forth about different environments where fixed may make more sense or dynamic may make more sense. But I do want to be crystal clear. Both are supported, and you can use either in production, and that's fine. You sure? You. Sure. Do you want a shirt for a big guy? There's a question over here. I'll actually be talking about this in the next session. Come to my next session. I'm in this room. So the question is, if I move a virtual machine from 2008 R2 to 2012, can I move it back? Officially, no. Have I done it? Yes. Is it officially supported? No. So I can't guarantee, we haven't tested that, I can't guarantee that that's going to work in all situations. So a question up there. By the way, you should come and grab a shirt, especially since I gave you a bad answer. So the question was, what about Windows 8? Yeah, well, the Hyper-V code in Windows 8 and Server 2012, it's the same. So everything just works. Go ahead. So the question is, good question, you'll come and get a shirt. The question is, I've talked a lot about SANs, what about network attached storage? And I'll be honest, we have a huge amount of stuff to talk about in storage, and I was only able to scratch the surface. So in 2012, we do now support storing virtual machines on SMB shares using SMB 3.0. Some of the key features for performance in SMB 3.0, first one, inbuilt multi-channel support, which is active multi-channel. So we're able to utilize multiple links and get greater throughput on that. And that, frankly, it's awesome. It works really well. The other thing to be aware of, though, is that if you're using SMB 3.0 and you want the best performance, what you want is you want hardware that supports RDMA acceleration. And that's a hardware offload that we take advantage of with SMB. And we're able to see staggering performance with that. I'm a little bummed that I'm not getting to do the storage session here. I got to do it at New Zealand. On storage, one of the things that I do like to really highlight is please go and have a serious look at SMB 3.0 in Server 2012. It is such a huge step forward. Honestly, I have yet to figure out why someone would use iSCSI over SMB 3.0. On the things like NetApp SANs and whatever SANs, most of the vendors are coming out with firmware upgrades with support for SMB 3.0. NetApp made an announcement, I believe, at the beginning of this week around that. So the question is, and good question, I'll give you my last shirt. No, he doesn't want the shirt, okay? I have one more shirt. The question is, does dynamic disk cause fragmentation? The answer is yes, but you don't care. And let me explain that a bit. From a file system perspective, when a lot of people think about fragmentation, they have this this whole mentality of number of fragments per file. So you tell them, like, I have a file and it's got 1,000 fragments. And they're like, ah, that's horrible. From a file system perspective, it's not actually the number of fragments per file that's the problem. It's how small your fragments are. You know, so the reality is on modern hardware, as long as the chunk that is a fragment is at least a megabyte in size, you're never going to really see a performance issue from that. And we've designed VHDX to ensure that while fragmentation can happen, the chunks are actually relatively large.
What about VHD?
VHD can have a problem. So that is something to be aware of. If you're running on VHD, in most scenarios, you're okay. I have seen some systems where things got pretty gnarly with fragmentation on VHD. We've done a lot of work with VHDX to make sure that that doesn't happen. So, question about virtual HPAs. I'll give you a shirt. Do you want? Yeah, come down. I didn't talk to that because we don't have. I didn't talk about virtual HPAs for two reasons. The first one is I didn't have enough time. The second one is, and this is actually similar to my Pulsar disk thing, is virtual HPAs don't actually perform any faster than VHDs, which is blows a lot of people's mind. They think about virtual. They think about HPAs, and they're like, I'll use that. It'll be faster. No, it's just the same as VHDs. The main reason why we did support for virtual fiber channel is because, as I've been saying, what's that one workload that people can't run? It's the SQL cluster. Yeah. It's always a cluster. So we did the virtual fiber channel to enable guest clustering. But basically, I actually can't think of a feature that we support with VHD that we don't support with virtual HPAs. So we support ODX, we support trim and unmap, we support live migration. All of that stuff is plugged through with the virtual HPAs. Correct. And one of the other big advantages of using virtual HPAs is you can actually run all your SAN management software natively inside the virtual machine. So you have an EMC, a Hitachi, a Dell, or whatever SAN. It comes with a set of management tools that allows you to do provisioning and so on. All of that actually works inside the virtual machine if you're using a virtual HPA. So I know there are more questions, but A, I'm out of shirts. B, I'm 5 minutes over. And C, I'm actually supposed to be in the speaker lounge now answering, doing something else. So thanks again for your time. And if you want, you can head down to the speaker lounge and harass me there, but I really do need to be there. Otherwise, they will get angry at me.